From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I said, look, we are 50, and we are pampered by life, but we should go back to the mentality we had when we were 19 or 20, and somebody told us, you have $19.5 million to make a movie, can you do it? And you should go, yes, we can.
Guillermo del Toro has worked with budgets far bigger than the one he had to make his newest film, The Shape of Water. But without having to worry about delivering huge grosses to justify the cost of his film, del Toro found the freedom to tell a story he's been wanting to share for years. Del Toro tells us about getting encouragement from fellow Mexican filmmakers Alfonso Cuarón and Alejandro Iñárritu to leave Pacific Rim 2 and pursue The Shape of Water. And he explains how to film underwater scenes on the cheap without any water. But first on the news banter, existential dread. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, huge news this past week. You know, we knew it was coming, but now that it's real, it feels so sort of disruptive and scary to a lot of people in this industry, which is the Disney acquisition of most of Fox. Fox will keep Fox News, and they'll keep some sports stuff. You know, we don't know what will happen to this TV channel that brings you The Simpsons and Empire and various shows. That stuff stays with the Murdochs, but the film studio, the TV studio that makes a lot of this programming and programming on other networks like Modern Family on ABC, Fox Searchlight, all of this property is going to Disney. A lot of intellectual property, very valuable, but hugely disruptive to this industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's $52 billion worth of intellectual property and distribution channels is what's going. And once the shock ebbs and people start to really take a look at what this deal does to the industry, I think there are going to be a lot of questions because, yes, Disney is a massive conglomerate that has a lot of ways to exploit a lot of these franchises, but they haven't quite explained how the actual infrastructure will work. Is the Fox Film Studio going to now become a division under the larger Disney banner where they have Lucasfilm and they have Marvel and they have Disney Animation? Is the network side of the business, like the Nat Geo Network and FX, are those going to become part of the Disney family or are they going to operate on their own? These things are going to result in massive upheaval within the industry, from the top executives all the way down to people who are distribution, marketing, publicity, all these people. Disney says they're going to save $2 billion in synergies, and that just equals job losses.
That comes from somewhere. Yeah, and you know, Fox was a place I think that had the reputation as not the most open-handed studio, but a studio where you didn't, you know, they tried to avoid getting rid of people, you know, helter-skelter the way some other studios have done. I was talking to someone there yesterday. I had lunch on the lot. It was a strange feeling with this deal hanging over the lot, and I was told about this recognition recently of an employee who's been there for 50 years. So this is a legacy property, and now there are going to be five major studios and not six. And of all the things that people thought was coming, they thought, would Paramount make it? Would Sony Pictures make it? These are considered the weaker players. And yet Rupert Murdoch, who just was talking about buying Time Warner a few years ago, is suddenly selling. So yeah, that's going to reverberate.
And the question is, what's next? I mean, if I was at Sony and Paramount and even, you know, even Warner Brothers,
even CBS,
wonder,
honestly,
Yeah, I would wonder, is this going to set off a wave of consolidation where in a year or two, we're down to four, maybe three studio conglomerates?
Yeah, I mean, it's very frightening for people. I think that size matters, and that's what Murdoch concluded. And of course, there may be antitrust considerations because this is very much of a horizontal type of merger in many ways. But I will point out that Rupert Murdoch has been carrying a lot of water for this administration with Fox News, and I imagine that Trump is not going to allow problems with a deal that Rupert Murdoch wants.
No, and all that Trump cares about is Fox News, and that is staying right with the Murdoch family where Trump likes
it. Yes, I heard he was calling to check on that to make sure. So he was a little afraid it might get into the hands of Bob Iger, who's had his own political ideas possibly, but he's staying longer now until 2021. And I say eyes on Peter Rice, the highest person at Fox, who's a non-Murdoch. He's British, but he could, in fact, be a successor to Bob Iger. I see that a lot more credible. He's been well-groomed. He presents well. James Murdoch, I don't know. They are talking about a role for him at Disney, but I wouldn't bet on it being something fabulous.
Well, it's very interesting that James Murdoch was not given an explicit role in the announcement. Bob Iger said, oh, yes, there may be a role for James. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement when the leverage in the deal making was to get James a job at Disney. And the fact that they didn't have that in the announcement is a red flag for them.
I mean, yeah, I would say as if, you know, you're not going to tell Disney what to do with their employment decisions. Now, let me pivot quickly to sexual harassment. We've had more accusers coming out and some more people who have fallen, notably Tavis Smiley. Morgan Spurlock, like, outed himself with allegations. I don't know if anybody was threatening him. More accusers of Russell Simmons. And the thing I'm seeing, you know, a lot of these men, including notoriously Harvey Weinstein, keep saying, I thought it was consensual. And at this point, I'm starting to wonder. Some of them seem so genuinely shocked. You feel like, are you in fact delusional and told yourself that? I don't think that was the case with Harvey. I don't know. I'm not his therapist, if he has one. But boy, it sure seems like these guys are surprised and shocked by these allegations. And I'm truly wondering, do they know what they were doing or did they convince themselves that they weren't doing anything wrong?
Well, what are you going to say? I mean, let's think about
that's true. Your options are narrow.
Yeah. I mean, the options are I am a harasser / groper / rapist or whatever you're being accused of, or I believed this interaction to be something different. I don't want to diminish their side of it. If they believe that this was consensual, that, you know, I wasn't there. I don't know. But we've seen it with these apologies that aren't really apologies and the I don't recall and I am sorry if I did something that offended you. Like, those kinds of statements really are designed to be sympathetic, but not necessarily admit guilt.
Yeah, it's a very tough thing to either say, yes, I did it, and I'm sorry, or I didn't really think I was doing it. And this isn't over. We're months into it now, and there's more. So we'll follow that. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new movie, The Shape of Water, set in 1960s Baltimore, begins with the dreary life of Eliza, a mute cleaning woman played by Sally Hawkins. Each day, Eliza wakes up at the same time, eats the same meal, visits a reclusive friend, and then heads off to work the overnight shift at a secretive government facility. There she cleans alongside her friend, Zelda, played by Octavia Spencer, who likes to complain about her good-for-nothing husband and does enough talking for the both of them.
And then I get home. And I make him breakfast. Eggs, bacon, and butter toast. I butter the man's toast, Eliza. Mm-hmm. Both sides.
One day, the two cleaning women overhear their employers discussing something they're calling the asset. Eliza and Zelda soon discover what it is, a creature living in a large, water-filled cylinder in the lab.
Get them out.
Guillermo del Toro co-wrote and directed The Shape of Water. In the past, del Toro has created many memorable creatures for his films, including Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth. Last time del Toro was on The Business, he talked about his attempt to bring his unique perspective to the big-budget monster robot film Pacific Rim. Boy, so you were here. We were here. Summer 2013. Pacific Rim.
Yes.
So before we get to your movie, I'll just ask you, since the show is The Business, that's a legendary film.
Yes.
There's been all kinds of goings-on at Legendary.
Yes.
Did you feel any of this?
The seismic change?
Thomas Tull left the company, and then, you know, first the Chinese bought it, then Thomas Tull left. Mm-hmm. Then there was question of the financing, but the head of it, Mary Parent, has said she has the financing, which she seems to have.
Yeah.
Do you feel any of that?
No, not really, because when we were prepping Pacific Rim 2 after Crimson Peak, was that juncture where, for no given reason, they let go of the studios in Canada. And that was the juncture which I took to say, okay, I'm not going to wait 6 months. I'm going to go do Shape of Water. So I left to do Shape, and everything has happened during the prep and the setting up of the actual shoot of Shape of Water.
So you didn't have to do with Pacific Rim 2?
I prepped my version, which was I developed the screenplay, I storyboarded and designed the creatures and the robots and all that, and then that suspension of 6 months, I left and helped select the new director, Stephen DeKnight, And that was about it.
You're saying they suspended production for a period?
They suspended, you know, you have a thing called a hold on the stages. And when you get a hold on Pinewood Studios, they hold the stages for you.
Right.
But if somebody challenges you, which in this instance was Triple X 3 or whatever, the one with the Vin Diesel, and they came in and challenged us. And Legendary said, we're not going to challenge that. And that meant delaying the movie at least 6-7 months.
I see. They relinquished the studio.
Yeah.
So you said fine.
When that happened, I already had two guys on my shoulder, like in the cartoons, Alejandro and Alfonso, saying, go do the other movie.
Go do the other movie. Talking about Iñárritu and Cuarón.
Iñárritu and Cuarón. They were saying, just go to the other movie. And I felt...
They were like, don't wait, don't wait.
No, because they knew how urgent I felt Shape of Water was for me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, for the feelings I have about tolerance. And people say it's timely because of the climate we're in, but it's been timely. If you're in a minority of any kind, it's been timely for such a long time.
So long, yeah. So I've read where you said, theoretically, you should have had like a $60 million budget, but you had more like 20.
Less. I mean, the fascinating thing about this is a lesson I learned on Crimson Peak, because Crimson Peak was done for 55 and it should have been done, now I understand, for under 25, you know? Because then what that allows you is allows you to market the movie. It allows the studio
to spend
on marketing the right movie. But because it was 55, they needed to market it to the broadest audience, and it was marketed more like a horror film, which it was, and it was a gothic romance.
Right, and it carries this burden of having to gross so much to make it up.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's because if you fabricate a Gucci bag, but they market it as a blender, people that buy it are going to be wholly unsatisfied with your Gucci bag as a blender, and that's what happened. And the curious thing is what I did was from 2012 to 2014, out of my pocket, I financed the pre-design of all the sets and the design and the sculpture of the creature complete. You know, and then I had already pages and a beat sheet and all that, and in 2014, I pitched it with those elements to only one place, and it was Searchlight. That was it. That was my first and only stop.
I'm trying to remember if Searchlight handled...
They did Birdman.
Yeah, but you hadn't done anything with it. More.
No, but Alejandro's reviews of his experience with Searchlight, he said, you have to go there next. You have to go there next. And I went, and, you know, I wish I could say how dramatic it was, but it wasn't. I was prepared to do it for the number they gave me, whichever this number was. And then they said 19.5, and I said immediately, I said, okay, I can do it for that number if you allow me to, except for minimum guild minimum, I'll reinvest my salary as producer, writer, director.
Really?
Yeah. And they said, that's fine. And then I went to my partner.
Boy, you really wanted to make this movie.
Really, yeah. And I did it. Everything except guild minimum is in the movie. And I went to Miles Dale, my partner, and I said, look, we are 50, and we are... you know, pampered by life, but we should go back to the mentality we had when we were 19 or 20. And somebody told us, you have 19.5 million to make a movie. Can you do it? And you should go, yes, we can. And I said, a budget is a state of mind. And this came because I saw Alejandro. We did Beautiful. And then he said, I'm going to do a smaller one because Beautiful was a bit of a disappointing experience for all of us. Not artistically, but in the way...
Commercially,
and finding an audience. And he said, I'm going to do a small one. And then he does Birdman, which looks
small one.
five times bigger than Beautiful, right. But it's a smaller. And I thought, if he did it, I can do it.
So how did you do it?
Well, there's many things. The funny thing is some people don't believe it's 19.5, and
right,
it isn't.
I'm sure.
And it isn't. It's 19.3.
Okay.
I got back 200. We were able to give back the studio and recuperate 200. But many things we did. I can take you through the boring ones or the more ingenious ones.
Well, you are the storyteller, so I'll leave it
to
you.
Well, for example, I decided early on that the scenes underwater that needed more control, like the opening and the closing of the movie, which are almost like balletic.
Yeah.
You know? I could not build sets that size on a tank because, A, there's no tank in Toronto. And B, there is no money for a tank in Malta or something like that. And so I unearthed a very old technique that I used when I was an effects technician in my 20s that is called dry for wet. And that is you shoot these scenes with the people and the props and the furniture suspended on wires you fill the stage with smoke and you project what is called light caustics, which is the light of the water, through a projector, and you shoot it in slow motion.
Right, and that looks effects like, background comes in handy.
Yes, and it looks like underwater.
Yes,
and
it does.
You add a bubble here, a bubble there, a little bit of debris.
With the computer.
With the computer, and erase the wires. And you use a fan to move the cloth as if it was underwater. But that way, I had beautiful images on a budget.
Amazing.
Very small budget, because let's say that scene in a tank would necessitate an entire day. That scene not in the tank was 2 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
You just got it just like that with the wind and everything?
Yeah, with everything. We rehearsed it. We rehearsed the puppeteering, because each thing floating is puppeteered by an individual puppeteering guy.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. How enterprising, yeah.
Then, to give you another example, we had the wardrobe designer. We paid for construction on only the key actors, and the rest we scoured vintage stores all over Upper State, New York, and south of Canada. And what we did also is repeat extras. So we would put the extras that were on the street that had gone through hair and makeup, we would put them in the lab. We would put them with a lab coat.
Because they were ready for the camera.
We just were careful not to repeat them in a direct cut from one scene to the other. But these things, then we scouted very, very carefully. We maximized every single resource. I scouted 3 years before we started shooting. I knew where I wanted to shoot a third of the scenes, because I've been living in Toronto half of the time. My scouting crew was myself and a gas bill.
Your gas for the car. For the car.
Yeah.
So you drove around and found your scenes, your locations.
A lot of them, because we had used the theater, the cinema that she lives above, we had used on The Strain. It's a location that's called Massey Hall. So, you know, the luxury of these movies, I had basically 3 years of time.
You pondered how to do it.
To ponder how to do it.
Yeah. It seems to me that you maybe found it very bracing to have to do it that way.
Yes.
And freeing in that, you know, again, the box office isn't looming in the distance. Like,
yes.
I'd better make this much gross.
Yes.
Or I've screwed it up.
Well, it's what, when Pacific Rim grosses $415 million worldwide, which is massive, and it was one of the top franchises, top original content, not franchise movies that year. Nevertheless, because it costed $195, you know, you have that burden.
Yeah.
So it's an
incredible.
I mean,
the marketing adds another
yes.
huge amount, 100, 150, whatever
yeah.
they spend.
Yeah. So with this, you don't have that burden. You know that if you do your job right, the movie worldwide will find an audience, and it relaxes you. And it's the exchange, right? The exchange rate is money and freedom. It's a sliding scale. More money. Not that they censor you. I haven't had creative problems since 1997 when I did Mimic. You know, since then I've been in complete freedom, but you burden yourself.
Coming up after a short break, Guillermo del Toro tells us about the painstaking work that went into making his Shape of Water sea creature sexy. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Guillermo del Toro about his new film, The Shape of Water, which just received 7 Golden Globe nominations, including in the categories of Best Drama and Best Director. The Shape of Water is, at its heart, a love story. Eliza, played by Sally Hawkins, is a mute cleaning woman who works at a secretive government facility. There, she encounters a captive creature being studied by scientists. This amphibious man, played by Doug Jones, is covered in iridescent blue-green scales, and almost instantly, Eliza feels a powerful connection with him. Michael Shannon plays a military man who captured the creature in the Amazon and brought him to the government scientists. He cautions Eliza not to get too attached.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on 2 legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
Tell me about designing the creature. The creature in the film, is not a CG creature?
No.
Because I kind of read that it was physical, but I thought, really? Is that it? Because it has that fantastic look, you know, a little bit.
It's physical. I think that I mean,
the eyes, especially.
The eyes, what we do is we sculpt them. There's so much artistry in the eyes because they're layered like an opal. There are layers and layers of iridescence, of flocking, of golden particles. The iris has depth. The pupil has depth. And at the end, we sculpt the upper surface, which is not round. It has, like, all our eyes have veins and pores and bumps. You know, our eyes are not a smooth dome, and therefore they are very alive. And then we scan that, and what we did is it's a physical suit with makeup effects on the face. The mechanized gills on the sides of the neck are mechanized on a little motor on his back, you know. Doesn't feel that is a digital creature. It's a physical makeup with the occasional tweak digitally.
And this notion of the sea creature, mm-hmm. I mean, you've been carrying that around for a long time.
Yeah, since I was six.
That's a long time.
A long time. But when I became enamored of the idea of the creature from Black Lagoon and Julie Adams being in love when I was a kid. But then I've been trying to do it and I pitched it at different studios as a straight out sort of Beauty and the Beast version of the tale, but it didn't work. And then in December 2011, while I was shooting test footage for Pacific Rim, I had a breakfast with Daniel Krause, and he told me an idea he had about a janitor in a secret government facility freeing this amphibian creature in a cylinder and taking it home. And I thought that's the key to it all. I had done already Hellboy 1 and Hellboy 2, which have an amphibian creature living in a super secret government facility and all that. But I never found the proper angle to talk about the story. And the proper angle was through the service entrance, not the front door.
Uh-huh.
That's what makes politically, as a fable, as a parable, it makes everything fall into place.
This need to get him out of
the empathy place. The empathy of the invisible people, the people that nobody sees, you know?
Yeah. So you blended this one idea with his idea, and out came this.
Yeah, I bought his idea in 2012 and started writing it immediately.
I mean, the height on the creature is considerable.
Yes.
And how is that done? Tall person.
My actor is Doug Jones, whom I have done 6 movies with and 12 creatures with. And he is, I think, 6'5", 6'7".
He's really that big.
He's really that tall. He's incredibly. And he was blessed by nature without a chest or a butt. So we can sculpt anything we want on him.
So he's wearing, because that creature has quite a chest on, and nice butt, I will say.
Yeah, we created it. It took 2 years to design, 1 year to execute, because we wanted, in the movie, he's clearly referenced as an elemental god from the river, or the natives believed he was.
Right.
And I needed to have the body to be, as I jokingly said, the Michelangelo's David of amphibian man. It needed to be the perfect swimmer body and a face that was incredibly expressive. So, you know, when you cast an actor, you need an actor that has a lot of range. When you sculpt an actor and paint an actor, you need to build that range in the sculpture in a way.
I will say that as I was watching the movie, I was thinking that is a very sexy amphibian man.
It is. Well, that was the idea. That's why when I pitched the movie in 2014 to Searchlight, from beginning to end, there's a moment in which I'm going to say, and they make love. And they needed to see the creature to understand what that meant. And the sculpture, the maquette, was already quite impressive at that.
So they could see that he was...
They could see he was...
A hot amphibian creature.
A hot sashimi.
Well, he was at risk of becoming sashimi.
Yes.
And, I mean, Searchlight was like, we get it? Or did they take a little persuading?
Well, it came with that. I mean, I said to them, look, these are the things that are not negotiable, you know? Mm. I wrote this for Sally Hawkins, you know? I wrote this for Octavia Spencer, you know? I wrote this for...
Where had you seen those actors that made you...
Sally, I saw first a long time before even I started the movie, when I saw her in a series called Fingersmith. It's a series for the BBC. And that is so tremendously beautiful. And she is...
Fingersmith.
Fingersmith. It's a Victorian crime story between two lovers, two women that are lovers, and they have to murder a guy that is opposing them. And it's a beautiful story. And I loved the way Sally fell in love in a way that was not fetishized, not titillating. It was just so raw and real and
emotional.
Mm-hmm. And I thought this is an incredible performance, you know, because the movie, The Shape of Water, one of the things I was very bent upon was that there would be no fetishization of the sex, that it would be a very beautiful,
romantic,
all-encompassing. And I thought of her, you know.
So when you wrote it, had you sort of gotten the notion that she was going to be in?
Well, I had no idea if she was going to say yes. But at any rate, you do that. You know, sometimes you write for an actor that is not even alive, but that's your range as a director. In this instance, I was writing for an actor that there was 50-50 that could say yes. And if I did my job right, she would say yes.
So you said these were the things that were not negotiable,
yeah.
And it was your cast?
My cast, the fact that I would have complete freedom, obviously final cut and all of that, but you know, I'm very open with the studios. I was open with anybody from Thomas Tall to Searchlight. I say, look, since Mimic in 1997, I do not read notes, ever. We can sit down and have a lunch, and you tell me what you like, you don't like about any of part of the process. But if you send me notes, I won't read them because I find them to be unilateral. You know, I really like that idea, and that was part of the things. And jokingly, David Greenbaum and Dan Tram, who were my executives at Searchlight, they said, we're going to send you the notes. We know you're not going to read them. That was also not negotiable. Not because I don't want to listen. I want to have a face-to-face.
And did that happen?
Yeah, that happened.
Did they persuade you to change anything?
No. It's been one of the best. I've had really good collaborations. The only horror stories I can tell you on a movie I've made is Mimic on Dimension Miramax.
And at that point you were?
Yeah, I was beginning.
Yeah.
So I learned to say no.
I mean, it's worrying now because it seems that any minute as we're speaking, they're going to announce a Disney acquisition of Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Then what with Searchlight? Disney's not in the business of making these kinds of movies. So
yeah.
Will they decide to be in the business to feed a streaming service at some point? Or does Fox Searchlight, you know, all these other studios have more or less shuttered their art house?
I can only say what I would hope happens. What I would hope happens is that it remains because for me as a filmmaker, it has been such an amazing experience to work with them. And the way they market the movie, the way they represent it for what it is so beautiful. They said, we want your input in the marketing, which you always hear. And then they said, who do you want to design the teaser poster? And I say, James Jean. And they say, yeah, sure. What do you want it to be? And I do a doodle. And they send it to James Jean, and that's the poster. And then they cut the first trailer, and it's a trailer with the French song that I use in the movie, La Javanaise. And I go, my God, this is the movie. It's actually the movie.
Amazing culmination of this vision that you actually got to deliver on your terms.
And delivered it. What is beautiful is we both accomplished what we set out to do. I ended up on schedule, under budget, in spite of such difficulties. Every day was very difficult. And they did deliver a movie that I have felt day by day that they have it by the hand, crossing every street.
Guillermo del Toro is the director and co-writer of The Shape of Water. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.